The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To tackle corruption in a meaningful way where Iraq moved up several tens of spots on the Transparency International Index or something like that would be a absolutely consuming job, probably a dangerous job for somebody to take on. So I'm sure that will be a focus, but doing something that's more than window dressing will be very difficult. That being said, I think there are several other key points of focus. One is addressing the grievances of protesters in Basra in particular, but elsewhere in Iraq, who have certainly a very legitimate gripe that there have been these building issues that just simply haven't been adequately addressed. Potable water, poor electricity, to name a couple.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for November 20th, 2018. Earlier this year, just as the United States was preparing to kick off its national elections, the country of Iraq was finalizing the results of its own, and finally installing a new government after months of debate. It was the fourth parliamentary election under the Iraqi constitution that the United States helped put in place, and the first since the Iraqi government declared victory in the conflict with ISIS that has dominated the country's attention since 2014. To help me understand what this new government may mean for Iraq and its relationship to the United States, I spoke to Jared Levy, the Director of Research Services for the Iraq Oil Report, a premier resource for Iraq watchers everywhere, and Rasha Al-Akidi, a native of Mosul, Iraq, and the Robert A. Fox Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, as well as the managing editor of Raise Your Voices, a digital platform that focuses on Iraqi society post-ISIS. We discussed the politics behind Iraq's recent elections, what to expect of the main figures in the new Iraqi government, and how they may try to navigate the growing tensions between the United States and Iran that are increasingly evident throughout the region. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 366, What to Expect from the New Iraqi Government.
Rasha, let me start with you. We know that this election process that we saw draw to a close in Iraq last month, to kind of a final close, or as close to a close as I think we're going to get, started back in May. And it came after a tumultuous couple of years in Iraq, to say the least, beginning in 2014, arguably even earlier, but at least in 2014, we saw the ISIS conflict break out, a major threat to Iraq, taking its territory, then in a multinational intervention effort there to combat ISIS. And then as soon as that begins to wind down, we begin to see more Iraqi territory taken back. We see this new conflict break out in late 2017 between Iraq's own Kurdistan region and the central government in Baghdad. That wound down before the election, but nonetheless was very kind of fresh on the minds. What were the big national questions, national issues that Iraqis were facing going into these May 2018 elections?
First of all, probably the security, and in the post-ISIS reconstruction in these areas that had been under ISIS control, also managing armed groups, the militias, and they were being incorporated with the Iraqi security apparatus, but it was also problematic in how they were going to be properly managed. And then just the basic services, which is the concern of the vast majority of Iraqis, as we saw later on. The Kurdish issue was also very important on whether or not the government was going to be able to contain Kirkuk, or continue to contain Kirkuk as it had. These were the main issues.
Absolutely. Jared, do you have anything you want to kick in there?
So the only thing I would add to that is I think there was sort of this higher level question of regionally and internationally, which way did Iraq's political elites want to tilt? Did they want to maintain kind of balanced regional relations with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, with Turkey, and more broadly with the US, West? Or did they want to tilt more sharply towards Iran? And you had sort of different political blocks running in the election who were speaking to those two different possibilities. So I think that was sort of like an overarching question that I don't want to say that was driving voters sort of at the ground level, but that was sort of a higher level dynamic that political parties at least were wrestling with in the lead up to the election. But otherwise, I think Russia touched on all of the key issues that were facing Iraqis.
Jerry, let me follow up on that a little bit. You know, we saw a few months at least prior to the election, we saw the then prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, it seemed at least from an outside observer's perspective, and I saw many commentators who kind of had this perspective, he was kind of at, it seemed like the apex of his political kind of sway. He had been fairly successful in managing this crisis with the KRG. He'd led a successful counter-ISIS campaign. He'd somehow walked that kind of, careful line that you were describing between Iranian involvement in the counter-ISIS campaign, U.S. involvement in the counter-ISIS campaign, also in the Kurdistan region element. And then as the election date drew closer, we saw that advantage, which maybe was never actually there, but at least that perceived advantage kind of dwindled down until we got to the actual election results, where we saw him not having, in fact, losing out. What were the results that came out of this election? What does it tell us about these kind of struggles and challenges that the Iraq was facing when people were hitting the polls?
Well, insofar as the actual election results, he ran a much narrower list than basically all of the disparate ethno-sectarian political groups ran on more fractured groups than they had in many of the or blocks than they had in previous elections, and Abadi's Nasser list was no exception there. So I think it would have been surprising if he'd gotten many more seats than he ultimately got, and his success or failure was going to be more about after the election, was he able to cobble together support from other blocks? And you know, I think you touched on something there, which in the months leading up to the election, it seemed like he had all these successes. But I actually think, and curious to hear Russia's take on this, she may think I'm way off base here, but I actually think in a lot of sort of political elite circles, there wasn't very much enthusiasm for Abadi. And even months before the election, this idea that the path of least resistance or the most desirable outcome was another term for Abadi was probably always more popular in Washington than it was in Baghdad or in Erbil.
Russia, what do you think about that?
I completely agree with that. In Erbil, and it was popular, not so popular in Baghdad, in Washington, yes, and also on social media. Abadi had that support that we saw online, but it didn't really translate on the ground. I would just add to what Jared said that he failed to carry out his promises regarding corruption, which I would add again was a huge concern for the locals if we're talking about elections. That was what drove most of the votes and why we saw Muqtada Sadr kind of coming back in and strongly into the political scene. He wasn't strong enough in confronting the corrupted officials. That was a huge blow for him at the popular level.
A name we've talked about in the context of this election is Muqtada al-Sadr, and it's a name that has been around for a long time for people in following Iraqi affairs, certainly for Americans that have been involved since the 2003 invasion. Who is he, and what is his relevance to the kind of election going on that he did not result as an official, you know, as anybody holding office?
Muqtada al-Sadr basically gets his relevance and importance from his family name, al-Sadr. Very prominent religious and political family. They go back centuries, not just decades, centuries in Iraq and between Iraq and between Lebanon. And post 2003, he earned a nickname, sort of a description, firebrand. That's what people like to call him. In that he was extremely anti-U.S. against the occupation. He did support attacks against U.S. troops, and then he sort of normalized the idea of militias from Jaish al-Mahdi outside of the official Iraqi army. It became normal and it became accepted, even if the government didn't publicly or officially support it. And from his group, the other more radical groups sort of splintered. And he's been a figure since. Now, his relevance at the popular level is because of his family name, is because he is seen as this clerical figure that people turn to, who answers to their basic needs, who is more at level within the less...
I think what you're going with is he's sort of the... He speaks to the blue-collar... urban
exactly.
Iraqi Shia.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And also because he was one of the few that were actually in Iraq during the sanctions that whole time. So he feels that he has more knowledge of the Iraqi people and Iraqis kind of relate to him perhaps more. Now, he's not a politician. He's not a cleric either. He's just sort of this figure that's there that people have to deal with. And because he has a solid fan base and he has loyal followers, he can send his protesters to the Green Zone and have them stage sit-ins there. Who else can do that? So that's where his power comes from. In the last election, the politicians in the bloc that he supported, they did fairly well. It was surprising to many. And now he sort of does control. I wouldn't say he controls. He doesn't have like the majority, and he won't be able to call the shots alone. But he does have now, at least enough leverage to sort of point things their way. And it's interesting to see how the United States is going to sort of balance with that.
The only other thing I'd add about Muqtada's background and political relevance is he's someone who I think is both mistrusted and at times reviled by people in Iran and in the U.S., so Tehran and Washington. And, I'm not reviled may be too strong, but he doesn't fall neatly into any of the sort of camps of the regional and international players that have a stake in Iraq.
Lynn, let me dig deeper into this question about that what Jared described as kind of the fractured nature of some of these blocs going in, that we're seeing narrower blocs among the more traditional sectarian mm-hmm. blocs that had kind of run in prior elections. And then we see this kind of, I guess, cross, what do we would call sectarian to some extent, blocs forming, where you had Muqtada al-Sadr, someone who historically, certainly for anybody who's gone through prior Iraqi elections, strongly associated with a kind of Shia nationalist bent, very anti-U.S. Western intervention, now forming an alliance around a kind of anti-corruption agenda with the Iraqi Communist Party and other people of a very different bent politically. What do you attribute that to, and how much is that a kind of redefinition of that we should see, expect in future Iraqi elections?
The Sadr and Communist kind of alliance, that's not new. It actually goes back way, way before, I would say decades earlier, in that kind of the populist kind of leaning towards communist and vice versa. So the alliance has been there for a while. 2010, I think it was first brought to notice when many Iraqi liberal activists, and I'm using quotation marks when I say liberal, they were very pro-Sadrist and openly about it. And it was a bit surprising how someone can be so liberal and yet align themselves with the cleric. But yes, sectarian lines have kind of crumbled. I think that was part of the post-ISIS phenomena we saw in the country. Also, regarding the other blocs, I do believe the fact that the other factions also had armed groups. We see some of the Sunnis, including a name that we're going to probably be talking about later, align himself with those groups. A lot of it was just a quest for power and make sure that they kind of stay in the game and they stay relevant. So they had to align themselves with the people that had the power at the moment.
One thing I'd add to that, I actually don't think Sadr's rhetoric has evolved all that much over the years. And frankly, I'm not sure that he has evolved all that much over the years. As far back as early in the post-Saddam era, he was talking about non-sectarian nationalist rhetoric, sending some of the Mahdi army fighters to Fallujah to join the honorable resistance, quote unquote, in fighting the Americans. So he sort of tried to play on these nationalist sentiments for a while. I think the proof is in action, and I'm not sure that there's been a whole lot of evidence ever of that sort of true nationalist rhetoric coming to fruition. Agree with Russia on the there have been an assortment of Iraqi political movements, to include the communists, who have drifted towards Sadr precisely because of this rhetoric and his connection to the street. So I don't think it's necessarily a change that we saw him align with the communists. And I'm just sort of throwing this out there, I'm not sure there really was a move away from when I said that the blocks ran on sort of with more narrowly than in the past. I don't think that was necessarily a move away from sectarian identity of political blocks so much as existing parties and blocks that had been defined generally by ethnic or sectarian identity running even more narrowly than in the past. So the Dawa party ran on two different blocks, for example. Abadi's block did have a significant number of Sunni candidates running in Nineveh and elsewhere, but I'd have to go back and look at the results. I think a lot of them didn't do that well, and ultimately, of his 40 or so MPs, most of them were Dawa guys or people sort of aligned with the Dawa party. I think he had won a few seats in Nineveh, probably has better command of the numbers than I do, but not a whole lot elsewhere. Similarly, with Maliki's list. And then again, the Kurds in some past elections had run on unified lists, didn't do that this time. There was no manifestation of one of these broad pre-election pan sort of Sunni Arab party blocks. So you just had a lot more fractures, even within ethnic and sectarian grouping. So I'm not, you know, there may have been less sharp sectarian rhetoric or sharp ethnic rhetoric, but there was still people voted. There was still a lot of voting along those lines, I think. Welcome to pushback if that,
no,
that
completely
seems wrong,
agree.
Though.
Even with the Sadrist bloc, it was plus, and Jared, correct me if I'm wrong, was it plus 60 seats that the Sadrists won?
Something like that, sounds about right.
About two of them were only communists. Mm-hmm. So the others were basically Sadrists.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, so we have the election results come out. We see how parliament shakes down, and then we go into this difficult government formation process. And this year we saw some of the themes of the election really manifest over the course of the government formation process, and that we see the emergence of pretty widespread protests, particularly in southern Iraq, in Basra and in other areas there. You know, widespread targeting a variety of entities. At one point, the Iranian consulate is burned down. And we see other official buildings being targeted. And there's just kind of a widespread kind of reaction on the street that feeds into this kind of populist message. What impact does this have on the kind of government formation, that this process and the haggling that takes place as the different coalitions try and come together and say, okay, who are we going to be able to support to form a cabinet, to form a government?
On the government formation, I don't think so far we've seen any really impact that these protests have had. What usually has been happening the past decade or so, when there's a protest and it does not appear to be going away soon, is that an official would come out and just make promises. Right, Jared? Have we had any other really reaction to protests? That's what's been happening most of the time. So far, I don't believe it really has had any impact. There have been immediate regulations and resolutions that have been issued to solve the issues in Basra, solve the water pollution. We haven't seen the results yet. But beyond these small measures, I don't see any really massive impact.
Yeah, I generally agree. I mean, I would say that the outbreak of pretty large and sort of aggressive protests in Basra definitely didn't help Abadi in the post-election period, and you know, probably contributed to, I don't think he had much of a chance anyway, but that didn't help his cause in cobbling together sufficient backing for another term. And yeah, I mean, it, insofar as the government formation process, I think it may have compelled the different political blocs to move towards formation of a new government more quickly than they might have otherwise. So I think you may have seen the proverbial horse trading process extend on a little bit longer if it weren't for these protests, because I think there was a concern that either it could spin out of control, or the longer street protests dragged on, the more it could empower Sadr by demonstrating that he was the only person that could either bring out or control crowds on the street. So I think everybody else sort of had a vested interest in getting a government together, hoping that the formation of a new government would at least buy time to calm things down. But yeah, I think that's how it played into the government formation process.
Well, and then, so we saw the election results were finalized after, by my recollection, a kind of brief Supreme Court spat in early to mid-August, like around August 9th or 10th, I think. Then we saw about maybe a month of debate, and we saw the election of the Speaker of the Parliament, right, Mohamed Al-Habousi. And then we saw, of course, about, what, 3 weeks after that, give or take, Parliament finally elected the President, Barham Saleh, and who then immediately nominated Adel Abdel-Hamadi as Prime Minister. So at this point, we have a kind of platform of the three main figures in the government. What can you all tell us about these three figures, about the relationship, how they individually emerge, their backgrounds, and what we know about their relationship with each other, what that means for kind of the new Iraqi government and its policy agenda? Rasha, I'll start with you.
It's new for Al-Habousi and Barham Saleh in that they themselves don't have that much of representation within the parliament. They were not elected officials. Previously, with Speaker Usama Nujafi, he had a significant voting in the parliament. Many people did actually vote for him. The same thing with the prime minister, and the same thing with Adel Abdel Mahdi, and the same thing with the president as well. They had their significant votes within the parliament. As for these three, they were not at all elected. So that brings a kind of a new dynamic into how the government is going to work this time. Al-Habousi was at some point, I believe, late 2016 and 2017. Jared, again, correct me if I'm wrong. It was a year and a few months where he was the governor of Anbar, replacing a previous governor who I believed personally was very successful. But again, Al-Habousi controversy here is that he was aligned with Fatah and aligned with the Hashid factions. And that was the controversy in how is he going to perform? Is he going to shift the Sunni spectrum towards Iran? Is that the new trend? We haven't seen that yet, but that's the question. For Barham Saleh, extremely charismatic. Washington loves him. The UK loves him. He's quite active. We've seen that already. He's going places. People know who he is. He's mostly known for establishing the American University of Iraq in Sulaymaniyah. And he had previously been part of the PUK. In the coming elections, and in the previous elections, he participated in the elections in an independent bloc after sort of falling out with the PUK over the referendum. The controversy about him was that he had sided with the referendum. So that was a bit in how he's going to reconciliate that fact right now as the president of Iraq, when about a year ago he was all for an independent Kurdistan. Adel Abdel Mahdi, I believe he's kind of like Abadi in a way. Like Haider al-Abadi in a way, that he's nice to everyone. No one has an issue with him. He doesn't really have that vibe, sectarian vibe to him like Maliki or like Nujafi would. So he gives out, he's just a nice guy, gets along well. But again, he does not have a strong parliament backing. So a lot of his decisions might be sort of curbed by Muqtada al-Sadr or by al-Amri, people with the larger number of votes within the elections, people with the blocs that dominate the parliament.
The only thing I'd add to that, I mean, I think Barham Saleh as president it's an interesting change in the dynamic from the last government, where Barham Saleh has a lot of established relationships in Washington, in London, in Tehran, in elsewhere in the region, and I think is going to be a lot more active than the prior president, Massoum. And, you know, what that brings to the table, we'll see. I think he's constrained because the job description of Iraq's president is largely that of a figurehead position. But I think he's definitely going to try to make more out of the position than his predecessor did. And then if you know, going back a few more years, obviously, Jalal Talabani was influential as a president, but, you know, the question is, was that because Jalal Talabani was a really influential figure as the head of the PUK, who, you know, basically was the commander of the PUK Peshmerga and just sort of a figure to be reckoned with in Iraq who happened to be president? So I think that charismatic as he may be and as many relationships as he may have, it'll be difficult for Barham Saleh to replicate the scope of sort of the role that Jalal Talabani had, but I think he'll be more dynamic than Fuad Massoum was. Beyond what Russia said about Adel Abdel Mahdi, I think an interesting dynamic there is that he does have this background as an economist, and I'm speculating here, but I imagine he may be more ideologically aligned with sort of reforms, reducing bloated government expenditures on public salaries, welfare, et cetera. But that is the opposite direction that things are sort of trending in, because as Russia noted previously, the response to protest is always throw money at the problem. So I think you've got there may be an interesting dynamic building down the road where Adel Abdel Mehdi is perhaps ideologically supportive of the kind of economic reform that the IMF has suggested in the past as part of the now kind of dormant standby arrangement with Iraq. But the circumstance and political pressure calls for basically the polar opposite of that. And then on Speaker of Parliament Helbousi, nothing really to add there. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Russia, but he is affiliated with the Karbouli's El-Hel bloc. So we may have, to the extent to which that will provide him parliamentary backing and sort of political support, I guess that's where it comes from. But yeah, he's not the sort of senior established figure that we've seen in previous speakers of parliament.
So this past October, late October, around the 24th, 25th, we see kind of the last step of this government formation process come into play. The new prime minister presents his kind of slate of candidates over the course of a couple days. Some are approved, some aren't approved, and we end up with this final cabinet that gets voted and approved sufficient to establish the government. One notable aspect of this, though, is that there are vacancies. There are vacancies for the Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Justice, Ministry of Interior, certainly three prominent ministries. This isn't unprecedented. We've seen prior prime ministers kind of have these vacancies, hold these ministries in their own capacity as the kind of acting minister. Prime Minister Maliki did this during a prior administration. But I'm curious, Jared, I'll turn to you. What should we read into these absences and to some of the other challenges that Abdel Mahdi's candidates for different cabinet positions faced in the parliament? Is it a sign of weakness on his part, or is this a strategic move on his part in an effort to keep centralized control over certain key agencies and functions?
I think none of the above. I don't think it's a strategic move on his part to consolidate control, and I don't think it's a sign of weakness. I think it's just that, you know, rhetoric about the desire for a technocratic cabinet notwithstanding, the security ministries are highly political positions. And my read on the delays is you've just got a lot of frenetic political negotiations over finding candidates that are sufficiently non-threatening to the different political parties that they can garner enough support in parliament to pass. So I think it's a product of ongoing, I mean, and with the justice ministry, that could be, you know, in theory, that's a position that can, that there's a fear, I think, that it can be politicized to go after people, go after, you know, the whoever holds the minister positions, political opponents, et cetera. So I think that probably what we're seeing here is protracted negotiations to find candidates who are acceptable to a range of political parties, and not either a sign of weakness on the prime minister's part or an effort to consolidate power.
I would just add that with the choices for the for certain choices that he had made and presented to be voted on for certain cabinet positions, they signaled to the Iraqi public that there was a lot of political bargaining going on and candidates were being chosen not really based on merits. Nepotism is still very, very prominent in this, and it was extremely disappointing to see that, and we saw the reactions towards it. I think with the interior minister, it's basically now kind of between the Sadrist and between Fateh, in that they do not want Fateh al-Fayyal. Is that right, Jared? Is that the issue right now?
So I think that what I've heard is that the Sadrists are pushing back on this guy, mm-hmm. Falah Fayyad, who is the former national security advisor, kind of was perceived as an Abadi ally in the run-up to the election, but then switched over to Hadi al-Amari's camp, Fateh, that Russia mentioned. So there seems to be a bit of power struggle over, and again, I think you sometimes see this construed as a sectarian power struggle over the Ministry of Interior. That's not the case. It's actually kind of within different predominantly Shia blocs debating over who the suitable candidate is. But yeah, so Falah Fayyad, I think, is viewed as a political appointment in the way that someone else might not be. So I think that's the debate, the delay right there is whether he will continue to be the candidate or whether somebody deemed more palatable by the Soderists will emerge.
And there's also sort of a arrangement in Iraq where the Minister of Defense is usually Sunni, and some of the candidates that the candidate that had been initially chosen shown to have connections to the Ba'ath Party, along with two or three other Sunnis who were also in slot for different positions, also that they had affiliation with the Ba'ath regime. Another one was related to someone on the parliament or another minister. So you have that too. It's not just three vacancies. There's several others, and. It was a bit shocking to see that from Adel Abdel Mahdi. It looked to be like the first political blunder on his side, presenting candidates that were not deserving of their posts, and also not being able to successfully manage sort of these kind of conflicts that Jared was referring to. And how is he going to sort of steer this? Shows us also his limitations to some extent between the much more powerful politicians and officials that have had that have the parliament support that he does not.
And that takes us to this question of kind of the policy agenda and what exactly this new government has kind of laid out for what it's seeking to accomplish. The line that I think we've seen primarily in the Western press quoting Abdel Mahdi and other people close to him is the focus on anti-corruption, a kind of a response to the populist actions that took place during government formation, kind of to the successful win of the kind of Soderist camp that has this mm-hmm. populist rhetoric. How much of that is actually, do you all anticipate substantively translating into actual policy maneuvers? And on top of that, what are the other major parts of the policy agenda going into this? Is a lot of it maintaining the status quo, maintaining the trajectory in terms of recovery from the ISIS conflict? Or is there a more proactive change that this faction wants to see made in Iraqi policy?
I think the corruption thing, I mean, I don't think that Abadi had limited success because he didn't really care about or prioritize tackling corruption. I think it was just a prohibitively difficult challenge. I'm not sure that, you know, I'd be pleasantly surprised if the current government has a lot more noticeable success. I think it's a difficult challenge to take on. I think there's some pretty systemic issues that are not easily fixable by just some piece of legislation. There's not just a magical piece of legislation that can fix this. So I think to tackle corruption in a meaningful way where, you know, Iraq moved up several tens of spots on the Transparency International Index or something like that would be a absolutely consuming job and probably a dangerous job for somebody to take on. So I'm sure that will be a focus, but doing something that's more than window dressing will be very difficult. That being said, I think there are several other key points of focus. One is, you know, addressing the grievances of protesters in Basra in particular, but elsewhere in Iraq, who have certainly a very legitimate gripe that there have been these building issues that just simply haven't been adequately addressed. Potable water, poor electricity, to name a couple. So, you know, how beyond just sort of creating new government jobs for people to not really do much but collect a paycheck, what can the government do about that? And I think that will be a major focus. An interesting kind of tangent related to that is how will Adel Abdel Mahdi try to revive Iraq's relationship with the IMF? Will they try to get the standby arrangement loan back on track? That's going to be really tough to do, as I noted earlier, given this sort of focus on job creation and pensions and welfare as a means of tamping protests. But I think if you're looking for if there's an effort to get sort of longer term solutions to address some of the underlying economic issues that Iraq's facing, that may be something that the government tries to revive in the next couple years, perhaps, if not right away. Standing up the Iraq National Oil Company, I think, will be a policy priority. There was a law passed in Parliament that was supposed to get the Iraq National Oil Company, or INOC, stood up by the fall of 2018. That hasn't happened. There's talk now about revising that law, but I think that is a priority of the government, is getting that up and running as something to separate operation side from the strategy and policy and regulatory side of Iraq's oil sector. I also think for Prime Minister Abdulmahdi, tackling this issue of relations between the Kurdistan regional government and the central government will be a priority. You know, it's not something he'll be able to address in whole right away, but over the course of his term. So he was oil minister for at least the first half of Abadi's government. And during that time, he successfully oversaw negotiations with the KRG that didn't address deep structural issues over the KRG's independent oil sector and its marketing of crude, but did allow for temporary solutions that put federal oil into the KRG's pipeline. So he has a proven track record of negotiations that reach some sort of fruition and change facts on the ground. And I think he'll probably try to build on that. We've already seen, since he took office, federal oil from Kirkuk enter the KRG export pipeline to Turkey. So I think probably going into 2019, and as part of the passage of a 2019 budget, there'll be further efforts to build on that initial success and build on some of the experience he had when he was oil minister and try to kind of start a new chapter, or at least sort of close the chapter of this conflict we saw in the fall of 2017 between the Kurdistan region and the central government after the KRG's referendum, and normalize things. And, you know, I think his track record as oil minister suggests there's some reason for optimism that he is a good guy to be able to do that.
I completely agree with Jared on the points about corruption, tackling corruption being very consuming and exhausting and almost an impossible task in Iraq, because corruption is so entrenched on all level of government. We're talking from the minister to the smallest employee in that sector. So it is extremely, extremely hard. But what the government will try to do for sure is to solve the basic services problem. So we're having water, electricity, these issues. They will try to resolve them as good as possible in order to sort of drift attention away from corruption, where people will see some improvements, because the situation is quite dire, especially in the south. And we see, if we take a look at the Iraqi budget, a significant amount has been allocated for the south of the country, in particular because of this. As for the welfare and public employment, the job creation points that Jared mentioned earlier, I think for the next 4 years, it's going to be extremely hard to tackle that. I believe the level of welfare and public employment is going to stay as high as it is, despite it being very insufficient and unnecessary in Iraq, because it does kind of drain the budget every single year. But with the populist sort of now in the parliament, and they have a significant number of members, it's going to be hard to sort of narrow that down for the moment, or, you know, cut salaries or impose some kind of tax. I believe that Abadi did try to do that during when the battles against ISIS were ongoing. It was a 3%, Jared, I believe, on salaries that were supposed to be allocated for the PMU, or correct me if I'm wrong. And that created rage and anger, and that salaries were not too high to begin with. And now certain percentages were being cut off to support the operations or the military, the ongoing fighting against ISIS. It's going to be really hard to cut back on these now for the next 4 years. Despite Adel Abdulmahdi being, yes, a successful economist, I do see him carrying out successful agenda within the oil industry. But when it comes to this, when it comes to the welfare and how Iraq has been set, where the vast majority of the population do depend on government-paid salaries, it's going to be very hard to change that in the near future.
Let me go from kind of the domestic then to a little bit of the international. Jared framed the election as one that at least a little bit has this question hanging over it of which way will Iraq lean? Is it going to lean towards Iran or towards the United States, or try and keep walking this tight line that it's been walking for the last several years? What is the direction we see that leaning now, leaning towards Iran first? We saw that one of the first visits by President Saleh outside of Iraq was to Iran recently, I think in the last 2 weeks or so. There's been a lot of controversy and questions about how PMUs, the popular mobilization units that are kind of armed militia, mostly Shia but not entirely Shia, that are now kind of quasi-official entities, are going to be incorporated, are going to be handled or wound down. What do we see coming out of this government in regards to this set of issues? And then just general foreign policy engagement with Iran. I'll start with you, Rasha.
I believe this government is different. And with the government is the general realization from the people of Iraq as well, is that no one wants a confrontation with Iran. And whether or not the United States has grasped this idea yet, it's hard to understand. Iraq does not want to be, you know, a proxy land anymore. So confrontation with Iran is completely off the table, regardless of the sect or the ethnicity. Sunnis, Shiites, no one wants that. Now, this is not to say that at the popular level, people do understand that Iran does not necessarily look after Iraq's interests. It's looking after its own interests. But there's an acknowledgement that it is influential. There's also an acknowledgement that it's a neighbor, and we have shared borders with Iran, and it's not going anywhere. So we might as well just deal with it. I think this is different in the sense that it's bolder now. I think Abadi, yes, was successful in sort of balancing, and also with the GCC states, he also balanced the relationship. I think right now it's kind of, this is where we're going. We're not saying we're Iran's allies, but we're not going to make Iran an enemy because the United States wants us to. And then the ball is now in America's court. It needs to sort of separate its Iraq policy from its Iran policy. I often say, I've been in D.C. now for 6 months, there is no Iraq policy. There's an Iran policy. So let's get a good Iraq policy and try to separate that from Iran, and we'll see how things go from there.
I think that's a great point that Russia made, that We've recently seen this sort of dramatic uptick in diplomatic engagement with Iraq by the U.S., but it's not because of some deep strategic interest in Iraq. It's because of the Iran sanctions snapback and an effort to get some degree of compliance out of the Iraqis. So current engagement with Iraq from the U.S. standpoint seems to largely be about a continuation of the counter-ISIS coalition. And then beyond that, Iraq insofar as it relates to. So there's not a lot of focus on Iraq outside the ISIS security sphere, just for the sake of Iraq. And, you know, I generally agree with Russia. It doesn't make sense for Iraq to damage its relations with Iran. That would be destabilizing. I don't think anybody really wants that on the Iraqi political side. I think this government, this Iraqi government, in many ways, in terms of how it wants to, the dynamics on the ground have changed, but how it wants to balance relations between Iran, Turkey, Saudi, the U.S., et cetera, looks a lot like the Abadi government. So I think there is some continuity there, although some new challenges to deal with, given the Iran sanctions and how Iraq plays into that. But I think the intent of the Iraqi government hasn't changed a whole lot.
That brings us to, I think, the other side of the equation, which is the American side, which for a lot of listeners is the one that's probably most relevant to them directly, as we have a mostly American listening audience. You know, we saw, obviously, the United States has been involved in Iraq in a very long time in ways that are often quite controversial, but has been involved with this counter-ISIS campaign that Jared mentioned. That's obviously still a major focus on all parties. But there is always this question about how much tolerance is there for the continuing U.S. military presence and other coalition forces' military presence in Iraq, and the extent to which they may have a tolerance for a presence that has a mission that's a broader set than just counter-ISIL, towards kind of providing security assistance, having a security relationship like the United States and Iraq had before 2011. Anyway, we've seen also some actions take place that have been put Iraq in the middle of this sort of struggle. We saw the United States shut down its consulate in Basra over security concerns, attributing those concerns to the Iranians. Now we see this new diplomatic engagement that Jared's described with Americans pushing to see sanctions implemented in Iraq, Iraqis kind of coming back, trying to come up, I think most recently with some sort of food for gas equation that they're trying to get permission for to get through sanctions. The sort of tension that Iraq's finding itself in the United States, is there, you know, hope with this government for a stronger U.S.-Iraqi relationship? Are we going to see a continuation of the status quo, which arguably was a flat line or perhaps a slowly decreasing line towards slightly less lower levels of engagement under the Abadi government. Which way is this all headed? Russia, I'll start with you.
I believe this status quo is going to be maintained simply because also in the United States in general, there's no longer really an appetite for Iraq in general. And once ISIS is defeated, again, I'm using quotation marks, because there is no caliph in Mosul or elsewhere. We have this idea here in the U.S. right now that there is no longer an ISIS concern. Daesh is not important anymore. It's not a threat. So why are we still in Iraq? Why are we engaging so much? I believe this is the popular opinion and also at government levels. There's not too much investment and not too much interest in Iraq beyond the fight against extremism or terrorism in general. And again, when it relates to Iran, I see that the current Iraqi government, again, will try to balance in just to achieve one thing, basically Iraq not becoming at the crossfires between the United States and Iran. That's the line they're going to play on. I don't think they're going to try to mediate between the two, nor achieve too much. Adel Abdel Mehdi, I believe, is trying to push sort of to achieve at least more exemptions from the sanctions, because it will harm a lot of Iraqi businesses. Beyond that, I don't see much changing. And this comes from both sides kind of lacking the ability to, you know, achieve more.
Jared, any thoughts?
I generally agree that we're probably going to see. If the question is, are we going to see the Iraqi government in short order throw the United States out of Iraq and say they can no longer have a military presence there? I think that would be very unlikely. I think within the Iraqi security forces, there's a lot of recognition that the continued role that U.S. Surveillance and air power plays is actually pretty important in making sure there isn't ISIS infiltration across the Syrian border into Iraq, and monitoring of existing ISIS cells in places like Nineveh, Anbar, Diyala, Kirkuk, Salah ad-Din, etc. So I think that it wouldn't, you know, there would be some pushback on parliament, for example, from the Iraqi security forces if there was a political move to kick the U.S. Out of Iraq. And I'm sort of speculating wildly here, but I don't think that Iran is hell-bent on there being zero U.S. troop presence in Iraq. I don't think they want to see a dramatic uptick in the number of U.S. forces in Iraq. I think if we started talking about tens of thousands, that might make the Iranians nervous. But I think a few hundred to a few thousand isn't thing that they are going to dial up their Iraqi political allies and say, do something about this. So I think that there's pretty compelling case that the status quo in the security relationship is going to continue. So I generally agree with Russia there.
So obviously with the rise of this new government, we see the exit of another government that's played a strong role or a significant role in a major chapter in Iraq's history. This question of the ISIS conflict and the KRG conflict that Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi led Iraq through. Just as a closing point, what are your thoughts about what the legacy for al-Abadi will be coming out of his government? What is his political future, or is he a figure of history that people will look back on, and how will people reflect on that? And what lessons should this new government draw from that experience that he had dealing with the kind of array of crises that Iraq faced during his tenure?
Well, I would say, he took over at a tough point in time. He basically inherited the peak of ISIS territorial control in Iraq when he came into office, and he immediately had to deal with that situation. I think history will look fairly kindly on his tenure. Yes, there was no real progress in tackling corruption. Yes, he had these violent, he kind of was shown out violent protests over services and unemployment, et cetera, in southern Iraq. But I think he led Iraq through this ISIS crisis. He was able to navigate pretty tricky geopolitical terrain, walking this sort of tightrope between Iran, the U.S., the Gulf, et cetera. We saw a number of regional crises in Syria, this GCC blow up with Qatar, instability in Bahrain, etc. And Abadi managed to keep Iraq of most of that stuff while also you know, by the time he left, ISIS had a negligible toehold in Iraq. So I think from that standpoint, he'll be remembered positively. Insofar as the lessons to the incoming government, I'll leave that to Russia.
I agree with Jared. I think Abadi is going to be viewed very positively. Also in just sort of the way that he conceded and welcomed the new prime minister without any drama. All we have to do is remember what Maliki did and how he did not accept being pushed down at all. So that was very positive, and it was very endearing to see also. As for the lessons, I would say, I think Abadi basically, I wouldn't say failed, but he was not successful in tackling the local concerns. There was a lot of focus on the conflict against ISIS, but that was in certain parts of Iraq. The other parts remained neglected, and basic services were still not provided. Lessons to this government is just look into that. At the end of the day, the people can. Iraq is a democracy, not an ideal one, but people do get to vote, and if you do not carry out your promises, you will be voted out.
Well, excellent. I think that's a great closing point. Russia and Jared, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Check out our new online store, the only place to get Lawfare mugs, Lawfare t-shirts, Lawfare onesies, and the Lawfare Challenge coin at www.thelawfarestore.com. If you haven't yet, take a second to share the podcast on Facebook or Twitter and give us a rating or review wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.